a nice quiet morning here on the last day of Tape Off Con 2007.
Quieter than most.
I think everybody's trying to recover from last night's or maybe this morning's festivity.
Everybody's conditioned or seasoned. That may be a better word.
I think that's a polite way of saying it. It was great music last night, both outside and inside. Everybody had a good time.
This is Lynn Fuston. We're here at Tape Op in Tucson, Arizona. And today we're talking to Bob Crowley of Crowley and Tripp. We're going to be talking about ribbon microphones and a little bit of the background of his company. And Bob, as we were walking in here, we walked past a medical conference.
That's right.
Where there were big books full of research, and you flipped through one and noticed that some of your work in there. And it's just like, I don't know of any other people in the recording industry or any other microphone manufacturers whose background is in medical technology.
Well, I'm not sure that that's strictly true, because a lot of the acoustics engineers who we know from some of the other companies do have or have had involvement in medical ultrasound in the past. You know, the two fields are quite related, but what Lynn is referring to is the atherosclerosis conference that's being held across the street, where people are meeting to talk about hardening of the arteries and blockages and what to eat and what not to eat. And in one of the journals that they had posted out on the table there was a thing called intravascular ultrasound, which is one of the technologies that Hugh Tripp and I developed back in the 1980s. And it was one of those things. It was a special project. Nobody thought it would work. And what it is a real tiny transducer, which is really just a microphone, just like a little mini condenser microphone that goes inside the heart arteries and spins around and makes a sonar image of the heart and the arteries and tells you where the blockages are.
So it's a mic that goes through your veins.
Right. Also operates at 20 megahertz, 30 megahertz, 40 megahertz, all kinds of bandwidth. But it's got to be, you know, something. It's interesting. It's a lot like microphones that we make for audio, because the same rules apply. You got to have a high gain. You got to have good sensitivity. You've got to have a specific pattern, you know, so that it will look at the right place. And it has to have low noise. And those are all tough to do when you're down at the size of a needle, you know, something that's so tiny. Yeah. So this microphone stuff, this is easy. It's big.
The music stuff, yeah. Big microphones, lots of space.
Yeah, and actually when you know, we're corporate escapees, like are a lot of people who we meet here at Tape Op, who have accomplished things in a lot of different fields, and there's a lot of extremely talented and accomplished people who are in this particular field because they love the creativity and the camaraderie that's part of the whole thing. But we have, Hugh Tripp and I, when we were at Boston Scientific, we said, you know, we would really like to do something that's related to the arts. And he was out of AR. He had originally been in the model shop, worked with Henry Close at Acoustic Research back in the 1970s. And I was out doing recordings and field recordings back in the early 70s. And, you know, out and around modifying microphones, and always loved things like the old 77DX and a collector of microphones, too. And we said, you know, something, these things, really, the way they're built today, if we applied the principles of medical manufacturing, the precision and care you need to put something into somebody's body, which is a big deal, it's a big responsibility. And what would happen to the sound? What would that do? How would that improve it? Would it make it better sounding? Would it improve the purity or the clarity of the recording sound? Or would it give us some kind of new capability that we would be able to add to the palette, so to speak, of tones? And, you know, the language of tone is a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's ever growing and it's ever changing all the time. And so that's why we decided, when we formed Soundwave Research only 4 years ago now. It's like 4 years that went by in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
But it's been a real success story. But only 4 years ago, we said we need to have a pro audio component to what we do, so that we can test some of these new materials and new techniques and new discoveries in our acoustic labs, and we can noodle around and we can try it on music before we try it on people. It's a lot easier that way, you know.
So, what is your background musically?
I'm the typical noodler, amateur guitar player, and multiple string instrument player. And I also play the shakuhachi, the Japanese end-blown flute, which is a really tough instrument to record.
Wow.
And it's a, you know, it's a wonderful instrument. I'm actually, you know, I'm kind of a high intermediate in that one. So I,
wow.
I feel fairly confident. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with my instrument there. But I'm, you know, always screwing around with guitars and modifying guitars and, you know, just having fun with that type of thing. So I'm not really, don't call myself a musician by any means. Chris Regan, who's part of Soundwave Research, is a very accomplished jazz pianist and also composer. And we've got other people who are, I mean, you know, just like so many of these different companies. I mean, you just walk the exhibit halls, everybody's doing something.
Yeah.
You know, because we're, and that, of course, that's why the stuff comes out good very often, is because, you know how to use it. If you're a user and you're making it for yourself, you know what you want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know what you want, and you can evaluate. You can say, well, this is no good, or this is good. And it makes it much easier. So anyway, we've been working on nanomaterials. We're involved in things like carbon nanotubes, acoustic nanofilm, and then also the exploration of what we refer to as supermaterials. And supermaterials are these very, very strong or very light or very conductive or very something materials that are just now being discovered and developed and applied to certain industries. And although it costs a lot of money to develop them, we try to apply the developments to different fields. Like, for instance, perfect example, one of the materials that we're developing for ribbon microphones also can be used to improve that heart imaging device that we were looking at that was done back in 1988. So we're going to go back to that.
Okay.
And we're going to improve that. They're going to be surprised, we hope.
That's correct.
Yeah. We also look into areas where people wouldn't ordinarily look. Like the materials, everybody's in bins these days, right? They look in their own areas. The biology people, they're just looking at biology, but they're not looking at meteorites, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yet there may be something in a mineral, in a meteorite, in a metal meteorite, a type of crystal or a type of metal. And in fact, I'm saying that because there is, that we can learn something from and then apply to, say, a new metal that we're developing or a new alloy. A lot of people know about ribbon microphones, and they know that it's a thin element of metal that moves inside of a magnetic gap.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of things that can be improved there. And that's, so we're taking those principles and testing them, and nothing's more sensitive than the human ear,
yeah.
You know? And so we try them out in some of these areas, and if it works out, it ends up in a product.
Your product line includes how many mics now?
We've got five distinct mics. We've got the Studio Vocalist, which is that bright ribbon mic that caused quite a little bit of a storm when it first came out.
Yeah.
A lot of people said that was heresy. And, you know, that's the way it sort of disrupted things a little bit. We've got another one called the Soundstage Image, which is a very neutral sounding, very strictly symmetrical and, you know, very broadcasty kind of ribbon microphone. We have the Proscenium, which is the more old school kind of RCA 44, you know, silky smooth, rolled off type of microphone, because there are still a lot of people who want that.
Oh, sure.
And then we have, although there are other offerings out there in that category. In fact, most of the other ribbon microphones are sort of the, you know, more reminiscent of the old school designs,
sure.
At least today. And we have our little mic, which is called Naked Eye, which we can't keep in stock, by the way. People love that mic because it gives them two voices, and you can move it around. You can stick it in the guitar cab and get all kinds of great sounds out of it. And we also have the Recordist Ensemble Stereo, which is a Bloomline type of setup, but it's really two separate mics, and you can use it as an overhead mic or spot mics or do whatever you want with it. So that's what we're making today, and we're located in Ashland, Massachusetts, which is halfway between Worcester, Boston, and nowhere. It's in one of these, you know, funny little areas in eastern Massachusetts that's sort of isolated, and we have our little workshop, and in the back of the workshop there's drums, there's guitars, there's amps, and all the stuff that you would expect, you know?
So when somebody opens up one of your microphones,
mm-hmm.
and compares it to another ribbon microphone that's
yeah.
out there that's currently being manufactured, what would they notice, or what would they maybe not notice that's a result of your work that's an improvement over?
Well, I think the things that they would notice, and there are some things that can be seen, and that's a very strict attention to tolerances and okay. surface finishes and surface quality and the position of things and how strictly and closely piece to piece we make them. And that's for consistency purposes.
Okay.
And that's important because you know how there's the whole matched pair thing, and sometimes people do matching, which is fine. We really don't have to do that. We can make them consistently enough now using medical manufacturing techniques so that every single one falls within a very, very narrow range of properties, which is really good. And so you can see some of that. I mean, you look in, you see the gold, and you see the different components in there that are used for aligning and centering and making sure that everything is perfectly symmetrical and rigid, very rigidly held, and also the heavy machining that we use so that things won't move and they won't dent and change over time, and also the material choices that are made to last a really long time. Those are the things you can see.
Okay.
The things you can't see are the acoustic modeling of the local field that we do, where we apply some of those principles, like from ultrasound, into understanding and then utilizing the way sound reaches the microphone, interacts with whatever it is that moves in a microphone, be it a ribbon or anything, and then is captured. And then, so you don't see that, but that's a very important part of what we refer to as voicing a microphone, sort of like the way you'd voice a violin. Or it becomes more of an instrument approach. And then another thing that you would not necessarily see is the engineering that goes into the magnetics and how you shape the magnetic field. You wouldn't see the material properties that are used in the ribbon. You wouldn't see, there's a transformer in there, but you wouldn't see it, and you wouldn't see the way that transformer is mounted in a certain position and how it's encased in multiple layers of material so you don't get hum and all those kinds of things. We try to just do everything that's possible to make it, you know, anything that we can make better. If we see it, if you say, well, it could be better. If you added a few thousands here, would it be better? And we say, well, yeah, I think it would be better. Well, then let's add it. You know, why not?
And we were talking yesterday about the tolerances and some of the construction of the classic ribbon microphones that have defined that sound, the 77s and the 44s, the early RCAs, and the tolerances there and the manufacturing techniques there.
Well, you know that I love all the old RCA mics a lot, and we've been working on those for years. And in fact, I've got several 77 DXs that we use in the lab. Every single one sounds great. Every single one sounds slightly different, because over the course of manufacturing those 77s, different people made them. They were made of somewhat different materials in different lots. They were hand-fitted parts put together, and also they use materials that age over time. So there's a lot of things that change in those mics. Now, that was state-of-the-art manufacturing at the time, right? When was that? When was the 77 first built? You know, starting in the 1950s through the 60s and into the early 70s when the last one was made. So over a long period of time,
They
probably went through, you know, several different people who made it and different suppliers and all those kinds of things. That's just the way things were. If you tried to build a medical device that way, you'd be out of business because it would have changed and drifted enough so that you couldn't continue to sell it. Now, I'm not saying that we're being strict or clinical like a medical device, because we're not, because it's a tool that's used for artistic purposes. But we can, we now, from what we learned after years at Boston Scientific, which is, by the way, a $7 or $8 billion company that makes medical instruments that go into the body, and Hugh Tripp and I were there from the very first days, so we saw that whole industry grow. But that there's a certain level of discipline and precision and care that goes in to the design so that when you build it, it comes out right 99.9999% of the time.
Okay.
And so that makes it easy to make it consistent and reliable. And then we do things like accelerated aging studies on materials. What is that? Well, we don't have time. We can't wait 50 years to see if it'll hold up like a 77.
Yeah.
So you put it through temperature cycles, and you put it through humidity cycles, and you shake it, and you bake it, and you do all kinds of bad stuff to it, and you see what happens to it. And through that, if you do it right, you can predict what the expected design lifetime is, which, by the way, for all of our mics, is the design lifetime is 50 years.
Wow.
Well, that, you know, why not? You know?
It's interesting. I've not heard of any other, and I'm sure there are, but in the audio industry, I don't know of anybody else that's
if you looked into
accelerated aging.
Yes, absolutely. If you look at the big microphone manufacturers, if you checked with somebody, a company that really has superb engineering like Shure, for instance, where where reliability is a very big part of their product. You would find that those types of things are done. But even so, when you introduce plastics, any kind of plastic, into a product, you need to expect some kind of change over a period of time. I'll give you a perfect example. The materials that are used in condenser microphones, the membrane materials, that particular material, which is can be a number of different formulations of polyethylene terephthalate.
So like PVC's Mylar.
Exactly. Yeah, those are trade. Mylar, of course, is a trade name for just, you know, one company's PET.
Okay.
And so there's all different hardnesses, formulations, modulus of elasticity. That stuff changes in the course of just a couple of years. So when they design that, they need to take that into account, that this thing is going to change somewhat. And hopefully the design has got enough latitude in it so that that change doesn't cause it to go south on you.
Yeah,
over a period of time.
Yeah.
But it's a pernicious kind of thing when it comes to the way we hear sound, because it can change very, very gradually over time. So classic mics, I mean, we've got them in there. I mean, I've got old, you know, C12 and all that kind of stuff in the lab. We're not really sure that they sound the way that they originally sounded. In fact, we're positive that they didn't. Doesn't mean they don't sound good.
So even if somebody found a vintage C12 that had been manufactured and put in a box and never ever been used, and in 2007 they found it and bought it and pulled it out and set it up, you couldn't say that that's what that mic sounded like when
almost new. Certainly it's changed, and also of course there's any electronics might have changed too.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, it might be no big deal, but it might be enough. And so in any case, our approach is to try to design the mic so that it's not going to change on you. And you know, I guess you're going to have to check back in about 50 years to see if what we're saying is true, but we're pretty confident that we're doing it.
Now, one of the things that I found was fascinating about the microphones was, because, you know, like any engineer, I opened them up and took a look at it. It's inside. You got to see the guts. Just pop the hood. But one of the things I noticed was how small the differences were between the microphones. In other words, each design was not like, okay, well, this one's got a different transformer, or this one's got a different ribbon, or this one's got a different motor assembly. The differences are...
The physical differences that you can see, you mean?
That you can see...
Yes.
...were differences within the head assembly.
Which you can't see. And yet little tiny things make a huge difference. I mean, that's throughout this whole industry. The sound is made up of lots of little things, so it's a lot of subtle things with respect to the geometry of how the ribbon goes in the magnet assembly and how the magnet assembly is shaped, how the acoustic field around the ribbon assembly is shaped, and what's done to that can have a huge effect, can have a bad effect too if you go too far with it. So these little tiny changes can have a significant impact. If you compare the proscenium, the darker traditional one, with the studio vocalist, there's a big difference in sound.
Drastic.
It's drastic, and you look inside those two things, and there's not that much different going on.
They don't look.
You don't see that. And there isn't that much difference. So that's why holding tolerances and making sure that everything is done to a T is real important in microphones. And then you give me any spectrum analyzer, any digital signal processing algorithm, and show me curves all day long, and you still can't beat the human ear in its ability to determine the character of sound and the timbre of an instrument through a specific microphone, or even you know, in a certain situation. So we're very sensitive listeners. I mean, humans are gifted of having maybe not the biggest ears on the planet, but we got the brains to go with it.
Right, exactly.
You know, and
sometimes can be a curse.
Yes, it can.
As recording engineers know.
Yeah, that's right. And as the lexicon of tone continues to increase, there is just like you need, you know, paint brushes and different paints and different colors for your palette. And so that's where we're going with our initial ribbon microphones, the Crowley and Tripp ribbon microphones, and also the Naked Eye line ribbon microphones to begin with, because we realized that that really did bring a more specific, more purposeful, application-specific kind of capability to the party that wasn't there before. And at first, you know, we had to educate everyone, and we had to bring in the gurus who really got it to help tell everybody else. Fortunately, everybody here at Tape Op gets it right away, and so it's, you know, this is an easy audience for us, because they immediately understand and appreciate the you know, the differences and what it can be used for. In fact, they tell us, you know, we learn from them.
Well, now you had a little slip of the tongue a second ago and said where we're going. That leads me to, so where are you going? What's next for Corellian Trip?
Well, a lot of things, and a lot of those things we don't know, because we're always in the exploration mode. But I can tell you specifically for microphones, we're going to continue to make ribbon microphones stronger. We're going to make them more durable. We're going to eliminate the stigma of the ribbon microphone that's still out there. There's a lot of myths.
A lot of myths.
About it, and it takes time for those things to fade into the past. It's sort of like, you know, all cars had cranks for a while, you know, and it took a while for that to, you know, and the choke goes away and that type of thing. So we're going to do that, and we're going to make microphones that stand up and can be used in applications, ribbon microphones that can be used in applications that traditionally have been used, served by other types such as dynamics or condenser microphones. We're already doing that with the studio vocalist. That's the heresy part, and it's kind of fun to do that.
Yeah.
And although I have to, you know, I mean, you know, you and I know that microphones are like pants. You know, sometimes it's either it fits or it doesn't,
yeah.
And you don't know until you try it and all that kind of thing. So we need to remain humble with respect to what these things can do and not do. But I can tell you that they're going to work. They're not going to break. We're going to be selling ribbons, ribbon microphones, where you cannot blow the ribbon ever, and that you could apply phantom power to it on and off all day long and
that's
watch
heresy.
It.
That's heresy.
And
having a blow-up proof ribbon microphone.
We're doing that right now. In fact, we have microphones that are out in the field. I'm free to talk about it right now. We have a new model called El Diablo, which we're co-developing with the help of some of our friends. And we've got that
in this field,
in this field, and okay. We've got, you know, we put it in the kick drum and tell them to wail away, and you can't do anything to it. It's an indestructible type of ribbon, and the reason that we can do that is because of that meteorite idea, where we're able to say, hey, here's an alloy that has a special property, and then explore it, and then there's the money. You got to invest quite a bit of money to get the get that made, or to come get the process equipment in-house, which we do. And these are very thin, tiny nanomaterials. And then you end up with a new type of material that has all the qualities that you're looking for, which is, in the case of a ribbon, by the way, for those who don't know, traditionally it's been a piece of aluminum foil. And if you take any, like, kitchen foil or whatever, you see you bend it and it holds shape, right? But if you bend it too far, it'll deform. And that's just the property of aluminum.
Yeah.
And that's been the problem.
People may not realize is how thin, when you mention aluminum foil, what people may not realize is how thin
right.
aluminum is.
That's right. It can be down to 1/100th the thickness of ordinary kitchen foil, you know.
Wow.
And so what you got to do is you got to be able to make it return to shape every single time. So no matter what happens to it, firecrackers, M80s, you know, next to it, people blowing into it, wind gusts dropping from the ceiling. We're already able to withstand rough handling. And the mics that we make already have fallen from the ceiling of Jordan Hall enough times and survived.
Wow.
so that we know that that they stand up under very, very extreme conditions. And the number of microphones that we have got back for re-ribboning, for blown ribbonings, has been exactly zero so far.
Wow.
You know, because they are very tough. And we're going to make them even tougher so that we can tell people that they will never have to worry about that part of it again. We hope that, I mean, that's only part of the story. We hope that when we do that, that will encourage more people to not treat them quite so kindly. We, you know, and use it as a real tool and not have to worry about them, because a lot of people do worry about the about the ribbons.
Yeah, it's almost like they're afraid to get them out and use them.
Right, exactly.
Because it's like, well, you know, I'd love to hear what it sounds like, but I'm afraid I might blow it up.
You can't blow these things up. Yeah, yeah. And other manufacturers have helped, you know, move the ball forward, too. I mean, obviously, Royer has done a lot to modernize the classic designs and show that it can be done. And we like those guys a lot. And there's some others, too, that are out there doing research and things like that. Because we're a sort of a full-service, quote-unquote, acoustics laboratory and materials laboratory, we feel we really have a strong handle in that particular area. So we're going to be able to manufacture it. I have to point out, we make everything in Ashland, Massachusetts. We don't go offshore for anything.
Well, now, I was going to ask, because I heard rumors when The Naked Eye came out that, you know, all the Crowleyan trips were at a certain price point, and then The Naked Eye came out, and it was like half as much. And I heard people say, oh, yeah, it's because they're having it built offshore.
No. Absolutely not. Okay. No way. Not in my lifetime.
Okay.
I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah.
But people have a reason to be suspicious because, unfortunately, there are a few that, makers of products that are sold here and are, you know, get the Made in USA label that are really only assembled here in the United States out of parts that are purchased outside of the U.S., from places where they pay people 10 cents an hour. That's another story for another day. You know, I don't want to get into the politics.
What is the definition of made in the USA?
It means the Federal Trade Commission has a very specific law, and it means that all or substantially all of the product must be sourced in the USA. So that means the components, the materials, and then the final assembly and the work and just, you know, everything, all or substantially all. The example they give is the gas grill. All the gas grill is made in Texas, but the knobs come from Mexico, then they can say made in USA because the knobs don't really add that much. You know, it's not, they're inconsequential. But if the burner was made in Mexico, you can't say made in USA.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's a very strict rule. And fortunately, we're protected by a law called the Lanham Act. And the Lanham Act protects the made in USA situation, and companies that, you know, egregiously violate it sometimes run afoul of that, and but we try to educate the customers. We try to educate the other manufacturers who we might work with. We don't cast any aspersions at anybody who is going offshore, because we know that there's a lot of things you can do when you have 10 cents an hour labor available to you that you just wouldn't be able to do. I mean, you can just do design and you can send it over to China. There's any number of manufacturing locations in China, and some of them, like Tektronix, has a Chinese manufacturing location. They do a very good job. And there's, you know, there are others that may not be good. One of the things, however, that we're concerned about is intellectual property protection.
That's a big one.
I've got over 100 U.S. and foreign patents, and you know, patents are like songs. And yeah. Writing patents is, it's like songwriting. Not every one is a hit. But when you see one that is a good one get copied by some offshore manufacturer and come in through the port of Los Angeles, and there's nothing you can do about it, I mean, that's a sorry thing. And so we try we're not trying to stop them. What we're trying to do is we're trying to educate them. So we're filing for patents in China, we're filing for patents, and we have patents and patent pending in Japan and Europe and all of in the United States and so forth. And then what we're doing is, if there is something which we think is likely to get copied or mimicked, we go to the manufacturers prospectively, ahead of time, and we offer them the opportunity to work with us, to license and so forth. So number one, they're already on notice before the deed is done that it's available on a fair basis, because, you know, sharing is part of this too. It's you can't just be in a vacuum. You've got to be part of the community too. And licensing is something that we've done very successfully. We've licensed, we work in other areas like Wi-Fi and cell phones and things like that. We licensed hands-free car kits to Nokia. That's one of the things we did, you know. So we try to get the stuff out there.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's fun being in this field, though, where creativity is appreciated, people get it, and it has an artistic purpose.
Yeah. Whether it's financially rewarded or not.
Well, sure, sure it is. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, the profits in medical are higher than they are in pro audio, but pro audio is growing pretty fast still in a lot of areas. And because we're able to do what's known as design for manufacturing and control our what's called cost of goods, it's kind of a manufacturing term. When you control your cost of goods, you know how much it's going to cost you to make the product, and then you know how much money you have left over to make when you sell it. And so we're able to offer something like the Naked Eye, for instance, which people were suspicious when they saw the low price. We were able to offer it at that price and still make a fair profit on it because of the design for manufacturing that went into that particular microphone, which, by the way, we learned from the previous microphones.
Right, exactly. It's not like you're designing something from scratch. It's like you don't need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, we use all the modern design tools now that people are using, like SolidWorks, and you know, we program in Mastercam, and we have Haas CNC milling machines. In fact, I just bought a new one, and you know, it's our new baby. It's like a big Zamboni with no wheels. It's occupying all the space we have, but you know, we're up to date in all those things too.
Well, now tell me, just because of the technology, and other people may not know, tell me about your project where you disassembled the 77.
Oh, that was something. That was in 2001 and 2002, when I was still at Boston Scientific, and I was making my preparation for my escape. And I was really, really interested and fascinated by the complexity of the 77DX, which has some 200 bits and pieces in it, depending upon which one.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So what we did was we got a couple of good ones, and we took them completely apart, and we analyzed all the pieces, and we did lots of measurements on everything, including the transformers, and we listened to them. And we talked to people about
Measurements. You're talking about dimensions,
yeah,
as opposed to like sonic measurements.
Yeah, I've got a book that's about 2 inches thick, plus a CD that's filled with drawings of every component of the SolidWorks drawing of every component of the 77DX. So if somebody wanted to manufacture it, we've got the whole, you know, the whole thing, all
the blueprints sitting there,
all the blueprints. And it wasn't because we're just trying to reverse engineer it, but we wanted to understand what it was that. And learn from it. And when we looked at it, we said, well, this is just not a manufacturable product in a modern manufacturing environment.
And one of the things that people may not understand that made the 77DX so unique among ribbon microphones was the variable labyrinth.
Tour de force. Harry F. Olson, who was the RCA Labs head, Acoustics Labs head, and wrote the book.
And we owe a lot.
We do.
He's like
a saint or something. And we refer to his book very frequently. They kept adding features to their line of ribbon microphones over time after the 44s, and they became more and more complex so they could do more and more things. And one of the things that you're referring to, the acoustic labyrinth, is this backloading, like an infinite baffle type of effect, almost like an acoustic suspension type of system that was used in the loudspeakers later, you know, the acoustic suspension era of the 1960s. With Henry Close and some of the others, and that used a labyrinth that's like a folded tube, they call it, and it's filled with this jute felt, which is the material that was like a hairy kind of material that impregnated with wax that used to be used on the floor of Oldsmobiles underneath the carpet to deaden the sound. And that's what's in there. And they would, in the way that we learned from taking it apart very carefully, that they would do it a tuft at a time. They picked out a certain, to get the density just right, it was hand done. You know, so somebody with tweezers picked out a tuft of this stuff and judged it to be a quarter of an inch by 5/8 of an inch, and then would stuff it in the hole, and they'd pick out another tuft, stuff it in the hole, and so forth. And there was a lot of hand work and fitting, and you can see filing and things like that. Throughout the course of the manufacturing of the 77DX, and there are people out there who know a lot more about it than I do, even though we did this work. They'll tell you that, you know, there are a lot of changes that were made throughout the design to make it better, and so they do vary. But the long and short of it is, with the acoustic labyrinth and that shutter in the back, which is made out of, I believe it's beryllium copper, you know, this sort of a cam-shaped thing, and the fact that you've got three transformer or reactor positions. So there's a shunt reactance. There's the M position in the bottom. There's the V1 position, which is one inductance that's put as a shunt reactance across the output. And then there's a V2 position, which these are designed to cut the bass.
Right.
It's cut the proximity.
Music, voice one and voice two, which rolls off the bass.
That's right. You can get, I mean, obviously, nominally, you've got multiple positions of the shutter, and then you've got multiple positions of the reactor. So you can get a lot of different sounds out of an RCA 77DX.
Yeah.
And so you really got to know what you're doing to use the 77DX. And, you know, I have to tell you that we know people who use them, and they got it to where they like it, but they don't really understand how it all works. It wasn't really a very user-friendly type of thing.
Yeah. And for people that may not know what the Acoustic Labyrinth does, if you look at the back of a 77DX, there's a little diamond-shaped plaque, and there's a hole in the center. And it has three positions. It's unidirectional,
yes,
bidirectional, and omni.
And omni, correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
And
then there's also positions in between, which can give you quite remarkable changes in sound and all that. Anyway, this leads to the whole idea of hypercardioid ribbon microphones, because almost all the ribbon microphones are the figure eight design,
sure,
which is not suitable for every application. And so you're going to see hypercardioid ribbons in the future as well, speaking of things coming up.
Yeah.
And so those things will return, but they won't use Acoustic Labyrinth filled with jute felt from Oldsmobiles.
No doubt. Well, there are very few of those. I mean, there's the Beyer M160, which is a holdover from, I guess, the 70s, which is a dual ribbon hypercardioid.
Right. And then there's the Shure 330 is a hypercardioid design. And then there's the BK5A, of course, was the hypercardioid that RCA made.
Right.
Shure 330 was the one that Johnny Carson used.
Yeah.
On his desk. That uses a little bit different principle. That instead of using an Acoustic Labyrinth, has side ports, which redirect the back lobe, essentially, out to the sides. And so it just basically nulls out the back lobe. But as soon as you start to change the pattern, you start to change the sound. And the thing that people love about people love about the sound of a ribbon microphone is the fact that you, even in a mono presentation, you get spatial effects that sound, you know, that sound big.
Yeah, very dimensional.
Very dimensional. And so as soon as you start to narrow that down, you can lose some of that. At the same time, the ribbon, because it is a two-dimensional, not a three-dimensional moving device, think of it like a line versus a circle,
right?
Has fewer lateral modes and has less tendency to break up at high frequencies than, say, a flat plate. And there was a German scientist by the name of Chladni, Chladni, who, among other things, proved that meteorites were of extraterrestrial origin, and also showed how waves propagate over surfaces, and including plates. And he would use sand on a plate, and he'd stroke it with a violin bow to show the different lateral modes. Well, what Chladni shows us, and the work is still referred to today, is that you can get a lower distortion and a higher fidelity reproduction with a two-dimensional sensor than with a three-dimensional sensor. So the advantage is that you don't have that TIS high-frequency artifact, which used to get rolled off after a few passes over the tape head.
I was going
to
say, by analog tape.
And now, even, you know, despite the fact that we've got the granular effects of MP3, which is another annoyance.
I was going to say that's completely different.
another annoyance. Well, now, but the two exacerbate each other.
Yeah.
And so now we get some vocals out there that, and you get some beautiful, particularly female vocalists with a lot of air in their voice and a lot of sparkle and so forth. They're really starting to sound pretty sandy. You know, and pretty harsh, and so the ribbon presentation of the voice is able to restore the organics, get you back to, in some cases, you know, sort of the Rosemary Clooney type of sound.
Oh, that touches my heartstrings.
There you go. Do you know that she used a 44 at about 4.5 feet? That was placed down around waist level, and she would then tilt her head back and sing that way, and so that it picked up a lot of chest and a lot of the sound traveling down her body and then reflecting off the floor as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so you'll see pictures of her in the studio, and she'd never close mic, and she had a great big voice too.
Yeah.
Same thing with opera singers, you know. I mean, you go to the opera, and the thing that is always amazing is some of these people with these trained voices, they don't have to be very big people, and yet they have these tremendously loud, powerful voices.
And the ability to project.
And dynamics and control and so forth. And I was always fascinated by that, even as a kid. And when we were in high school and later on going out and recording, because we were fortunate enough to grow up in a town, Newton, Massachusetts, which has a very long and rich legacy of artistic talent, musical talent that came out of it, both in classical opera and also rock and roll, you know, Aerosmith and guys like that. So, yeah, we used to do light shows for them at the coffee house. So it goes way back. Now I'm really showing my age. Huh? Yeah. But fashions change over time. What people expect for the sound, do you want it to be super bright and crisp? Do you want the vocal to stand up in the mix and be heard and have a certain level of articulation, which I think most people do, and yet you don't want it to be harsh, and you certainly don't want it to be tiresome and get people to tune off.
Yeah.
And that's happening right now with a lot of the ways that you know, things are presented these days, and, you know, naturally, MTV doesn't always help with that. But so that's part of the equation, too. We'll see how it all goes. You know, check back in a couple of years and see. I know people are sort of saddened that newer, improved formats like SACD or DSD haven't really caught on, and it almost seems like we take a step forward and a step back, or maybe two steps back. But ultimately, we'll get there.
Yeah.
And things will continue to improve, and so we're glad to just to do a little tiny bit to help that.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Hey, well, Bob, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Len. Yeah, it's always interesting talking with you about microphones.
I love it.
There are a lot of people who are interested. I have a blog called the Microphonium Blog, if you've ever watched The Three Stooges, and it gets quite a few lookers, and we determined that there probably are several hundred hardcore mic freaks who are out there in the world who like the same things that we do. So
yeah, well, yeah. And give the address for that.
It's just go into Google and type in microphonium.
Microphonium.
Microphonium. Yeah, like Curly Howard said. A microphonium. Or go over to 3D Audio and find a link over there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's a lot more stuff over there.
It's the only blog that I read.
Thank
religiously.
You.
It's the only one that I found that I would ever go back to more than once.
Well, thank you very much. So, I appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Well, yeah. Keep up the good work. I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
You bet.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.